Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And for those of you out there that love specialty food, you've got a big chance every year. You must at some year get to the Summer Fancy Food Show in New York City at the Javits Center. It bursts the seams of the humongous Javits Center.
And it will burst your proverbial if you sample everything that is available there, too.
Yeah, you'll walk the aisles 3 days sampling, morning, noon, and night. And then on top of that, there are special dinners, private parties, and you name it.
The average fancy food show attributable increase in body weight is substantial.
And there's so many other things going on, dancing jelly beans, presidential impersonators, the special Sophie Awards, which is the, sort of the Oscars of the food world. It's S-O-F-I, all small letters, specialty outstanding food innovation.
Is that what it is? Okay. Yeah. All right.
Anyhow, but we've selected a number of those winners plus some other interesting products. And from time to time now, over the course of the next several weeks, we will be bringing you interviews with the principals of these companies.
And who's up first?
Well, every year we like to find a new chocolate or an outstanding chocolate or a new product of a chocolatier we already know. But this one was a new one. We just met Dick Taylor Chocolates. And so this will be first up.
And they're hiding. They're on the border between Oregon and California. And I'm not really sure why.
Yeah. And it's Dick Taylor, Adam Dick and Dustin Taylor, I think it is.
Yeah, okay. Shall we run the interview?
Yeah, I think I mentioned it in the interview.
Okay.
Go. Well, it's not hard to figure out why your company is called Dick and Taylor, because
you got it.
Adam Dick and Dustin Taylor. And
that's correct.
Yeah, and we've really been enjoying these chocolates. They're really excellent.
Oh, thank you very much.
Now, how long have you been a company?
This is Dustin Taylor, and we've been a company since 2010. We started, I think it was in October or November, around that time. And we started making chocolate just as a hobby, and so we did just, a day or two for the first 2 years. And then finally, carpentry and chocolate were both taking up too much time, so we quit being carpenters and then kind of dove into chocolate full-time in 2012.
So you answered my question. You were actually something else before you were a chocolate maker.
Oh, yeah. We have zero background in chocolate. We were Adam, Dick, and I both went to university up here in Humboldt. There's Humboldt State University, and we're both alumni from that, and then, became great friends and started working as contractors, or working for contractors as carpenters, and we play in a band together and just kind of really like different hobbies and doing that kind of thing. So for 13 years we were carpenters and got into finished carpentry. We restored a few boats and built furniture and instruments and all that kind of stuff. And then in 2010 someone passed us a random video of the Mast Brothers, like a lot of us inspired by those guys because they had these cool hip videos, and we had, didn't even know chocolate came from the bean, and you're like, whoa, this is amazing. Look at these burlap bags. And so we started just thinking we would make chocolate just for our families, just like how you have a beehive in your backyard to make honey. We were going to do the same thing with chocolate. And then, in 2010, there were so few chocolate makers, and it was kind of this pivotal time in the industry of it really starting to pick up, and so it wasn't long of us kind of having our little pretend business that really started taking off, and so then we just start following that path instead.
It's interesting, when I was at university, we had one of our friends was a rather unconventional character, because he signed up to go to divinity school at the University of Cambridge after working for 13 years out in the world of work, and guess what his profession was?
What's that?
He was a carpenter.
Adventurous lot, huh?
We always kind of laughed because Jesus was the carpenter.
Right. And exactly.
Joseph was the carpenter.
The other thing that was interesting about Mike Stevens is that he had an eye for the ladies like you wouldn't believe. Now he was not Catholic, but I did nevertheless and did nevertheless wonder what happened to him.
Well, you know, do you two intermingle with other chocolate makers? Because you're really an interesting lot from such diverse backgrounds. I mean,
I'll let Adam take this one.
Yeah, so this is Adam Dick, and we do. I feel like you know, in the chocolate industry, kind of prior to the like Renaissance of American bean to bar chocolate makers, I feel like a lot of the chocolate manufacturers kind of held their secrets pretty closely, and nobody wanted to share their proprietary ideas, whether or not they were proprietary or not is another thing. But I find in this kind of more modern wave of American makers, we're all, you know, all of us are pretty close, friendship-wise, but also I feel like there's a lot more transparency in the way that we run our businesses, and it's not uncommon for me to call or text another chocolate maker friend and ask them about, you know, some issue we're having or ideas or concepts and things like that. I mean, we are oftentimes sourcing beans together. You know, a lot of times we're all of us are using very small volumes of cacao.
Right.
And so a lot of times the easiest way to get cacao imported is in a slightly larger volume. And so if we work together or co-op together, it's oftentimes a way to leverage a larger amount of cacao out of a specific origin.
And do you know Sean Askenazy?
I do, yeah. Sean was actually, Sean kind of started a few years before us, and he was always and still is one of those makers that we, look up to.
And we love him,
We're constantly thinking, well, gosh, how do we make our stuff more like Sean's? How do we make our chocolate as good as Sean's? Yeah, he was definitely, kind of one of the iconic figures in, you know, the early American chocolate movement.
Yeah, but he was a high-profile criminal attorney, though. Did you know
that? Yeah, totally.
He got tired of all the death threats, he said. Now, I have a more mundane question. Because one of the things we noticed, we have a friend who has an artisanal chocolate shop, a retail shop where she sells chocolate. It's made by people like you, and that chocolate is retail is pretty expensive, but it's also expensive to make things in Eureka, California, because you don't exactly have people who are growing coffee beans close by, and. How do the economics of it work? I mean, you just have to sell this stuff for a lot of money in order to be able to make ends meet?
This is Adam Dick again. The economics really don't work out too well. it is a very interesting. This is obviously a very complicated question. The simple answer. Or one way to look at it is we are buying very high quality premium flavor grade cocoa beans, which represent probably less than 1% of what's grown in the world. So there's a very, very small amount of cocoa that would be considered real premium fine flavor grade cocoa. So that stuff obviously demands a premium price. Because it's something that's extremely rare and specialty, so that's part of what drives the cost of a finished chocolate bar, and why a craft chocolate bar is a little bit more expensive. We don't have a ton of mechanization, and we do a lot of stuff by hand. We pay very close attention to a lot of to all the steps in the process, which require lots of hand work, and that's obviously also very expensive. When you look at a large industrial manufacturer that has a continuous production model, where they're doing potentially tons an hour, that's obviously the scale there allows them to drive the price lower. So, the high price of the ingredients as well as the high labor costs are part of what drives the bar.
Having been carpenters, you're used to that artisanal approach.
Oh, totally, and I think that's one thing that really gave us a, you know, why I think a lot of people are like, well, how did you go from carpentry to chocolate? And I'm like, for us, it was like this seamless transition. I mean, with carpentry, we're working with rough sawn boards and transforming them into finished pieces of furniture. With chocolate, we buy raw cocoa beans, and through a carefully controlled or executed series of steps, you make a delicious, beautiful, finished chocolate bar. So there's tons of similarities, at least in our minds. So the transition was too unusual, I guess. But, you know, but the reality of it is, even with the price of the chocolate bars that we, you know, the price that we're paying for cocoa and the amount of labor that goes into it, it's still only, you know, marginally sustainable, you know, on all ends. I mean, we're not like, this is not a get-rich-quick scheme.
No.
And even the premiums that we pay, the farmers are only marginally sustainable. So, I mean, I think that there's a huge overarching issue in the cocoa supply chain as it is, and if we're going to continue to pay farmers incredibly, low, or small amounts for the cocoa that they grow, it's not going to be super sustainable for them. So it's almost like you need a shift in the entire price
yes.
structure, where like a Hershey's bar needs to be $6 and a Kraft chocolate bar needs to be $20, and people
yep.
need to be okay with that.
I think your market is worth that,
but I mean, hopefully the only way to get more money, at least in my mind, or one of the ways to get more money to Origin is to, you know, increase the price structure and be willing to pay more, for the cacao that we buy.
Yeah. Now, how do you go to market? Do you go through a distribution channel? Do you go through retail stores like Amy's here in Pittsburgh? I mean, how are you in that, by the way,
Mon Ami Chocolate?
Yeah, Mon Ami, yeah.
You know her, Amy?
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
She really knows her stuff.
Yeah, and so this is Dustin. For our distribution channels, you know, when we first started, you know, here we are in Eureka, California, which is the sticks of nowhere, you know, and so, you know, we're 5 hours north of San Francisco, is our, you know, closest city. And so I remember when we first started this, of course, there's the, you know, the craft chocolate boutique shops, which are really, they're really searching and hunting for what's new. And so, you know, a few of them found us. And we also found that when we got into shops like the Meadow in Portland and New York, or a few
yes.
iconic
yeah,
shops and a lot of
them.
Other, yeah, then a lot of other shops looked to them to get in there. So early on, we were just doing direct sales. And I remember one of our early sales schemes was we would, you know, we'd check the internet for, you know, Chicago, and we'd try to, you know, just Google search what are their cool shops, or, you know, where do we think our chocolate would fit? And then we would just email them and send them 2 free chocolate bars and see how it went. And that had pretty good returns as far as getting different shops and stuff like that. Now we're distributed internationally, and so now we have different small distributors that are in different countries. Here in the States, we deal with like a distributor for some Whole Foods here in California, but still the majority of our stuff is direct sales. So we have a pretty good shipping department in our backspace, and we still do majority direct.
Well, the way we found you, of course, is that we've covered the Fancy Food Show for years now.
Mm-hmm.
And you won a Gold Sophie, which is that's a major boost right there in your reputation.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and the one that you won it for was the Madagascar Sembriano, which I'm getting a little ahead of myself. I wanted to ask you how many different products you have, and they're based. I have right in front of me the Madagascar,
which I just finished.
Oh, is that why there's none?
That's why there's none in there, because I just finished it.
But I mean, it's wonderful packaging. There are these little envelopes for the chocolate, and you have all this information as to the percentage of cacao, the origin, where the beans come from, any other tasting notes you wonder. I mean, it's very thorough and researched, right?
Oh yeah.
And you do that for every single one of them. The other one I have here is a black fig. How many others are there?
Yeah, exactly. So
in our line, I think we have 10 bars right now in our lineup, and I think we're dealing with four or five. We have four origins right now. So when we first started, you know, the main thing what we're trying to highlight is, like you see that map on the back of the Madagascar.
Yes.
And, you'll notice the ingredients in our chocolate is just the cacao and cane sugar. You know, it's just
exactly.
Two ingredients. And so what we're trying to do is highlight really what the farmers are doing. You know, Adam was saying there's these high flavor grade cacaos out there, and we're trying to show that off in its simplest form. And so by not adding anything else, we're just trying to make that, you know, a very simple pure chocolate so you taste what does that bean from Madagascar taste like. Because that bean from Madagascar is going to taste totally different than a bean from Belize or Brazil. And so each of these different origins, different genetics, a lot of different things play in to that different flavor, but in our lineup we have four different single origins right now. We're often getting different samples and you know, seeing what's new and what we can try, and then also we make bars with inclusions where we paired that two ingredient chocolate with something. So like our black fig is organic Black Mission fig sprinkled on the back of that Madagascar chocolate. We do a bar with sea salt on it, some caramelized coconut on another one. And so we've got these inclusion bars. We also do drinking chocolate, which is our same chocolate, just shredded so it melts out easier. And so that's more that, like, European-style drinking chocolate. And that's what won a Gold Sophie last year.
Oh, so you got the drinking chocolate last year, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, for the drinking chocolate, we won the gold for that.
Now, what does the – you have little pictures on each of these packets. I mean, like boat building and sailing. What is that a reference to?
The reference is, you know, so as Adam and I were starting this thing, and, you know, you got this broad thing in front of you of packaging, you know, what's it going to look like? Well, we really want it to be authentic to us and who we are and location and all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
And so as carpenters, you know, as we're building this brand of chocolate, what we're really bringing to the table and what we're trying to invoke in our brand is craftsmanship. You know, it's like as carpenters, we're hands-on. We really nerd out about the craft. And so as carpenters, the pinnacle of carpentry is really building a boat, because a wooden boat, because, you know, you have to use hand tools. There's no magic machine to make a boat. So you really have to be hands-on involved. So that's kind of the correlation between the two there. Also, we love sailing, so you
okay.
know, the more boats, the better. And also, where we are on Humboldt Bay, used to be one of the largest boat building communities here on the West Coast, and so we have a strong history of boat building, so it kind of ties us to location as well.
And
all the artwork and stuff is.
Who is this guy on your little, these little envelopes come in a nice little burlap sack with a tie, and you have a picture of some guy who has a cap on, and he's doing something that looks like carpentry. Is that who it is?
Yep. Exactly. So that's us tying yet again our carpentry and chocolate making. So it's a carpenter with a hand plane that's shaping a chocolate bar. And so that's kind of the connection there.
I see. Now, one final bit of information, absolutely essential for all our listeners, your website.
Mm-hmm.
What is it?
Oh, it's dicktaylorchocolate.com.
Well, I have dtchocolate.com.
No, DT Chocolate...
is the email address.
Yeah, that's the email address.
Okay, so it's Dick Taylor...
Dick Taylor Chocolate.
Chocolate.
Yep.
Well, I mean, I think you've come a long ways here, and, you know, you're right at the peak of the profession when you're winning Gold Sophies, because it's a tough competition.
Oh, for sure. We were thrilled. I mean, we've just been... we were blown away by winning a Sophie... really twice, but I mean, to win Sophie's is big. It's been a big year for us. We put a lot of effort and time into this of trying to make your, you know, the chocolate better, and so to be rewarded with awards is very fulfilling.
Well, we better let you go back to work, because busy hands make light work, or light hands make busy work, whatever it is they say. I know there were sounds of chocolate manufacturing in the background. So thank you so much for taking time out to talk to us today, and we wish you continued success.
Oh, thank you so much. It was really fun talking with you.
Thank you
very much.
Bye, both of you.
All right, bye-bye. Bye.
And we sure hope these really brave guys really, really, really make it, because they're so dedicated to doing this, and there's a lot of competition out there in the chocolate business. But we must go on. So after we take a break, we'll be back with
Honey Mama,
which is guess what the other ingredient is in this. Well, you'll have to guess. You probably will, but wait until after the break, and then we'll give you a clue.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Those who are regular listeners to this program know that I'm both blessed and cursed at the same time with one thing. As I have no sweet tooth, really. But I fell in love with this next product, Honey Mama. And, well, listen to Christy Goldspeed.
Well, hold on a second. Let's give
Christy Goldspeed.
Let's close out the clue for them. Because guess what one of the key ingredients is in these, what are they called, Honey Mamas?
Yeah.
It's not chocolate in the form that Taylor Chocolate uses it,
no.
But it is chocolate in the form of chocolate powder. And the chocolate powder
cocoa
and the
powder,
cocoa powder and the chocolate and the honey that goes with it
and
the spices that go in it are just absolutely sensational. And we just can't put them down.
Sometimes I get worried about how responsive the guests would be. Some people were very difficult to interview, but here we've just been talking to Christy Goldsby from Honey Mamas.
We had 8 minutes.
We had 8 minutes.
We forgot to record it. I hope you're going to remember it this time around.
Yeah, well, Christy was listening to us rave on and on about a number of things, including the fact that we adore her product, which is, what do you call it? Honey Mamas is the company. And, go ahead. And you called your bars what?
They're called Cocoa Nectar Bars.
Cocoa Nectar Bars. How old is this company? I had never had anything
I'm in my fifth year, and we just entered our fifth year in January, so it's still very new.
And you,
it's a very young company.
You won a Silver Sophie?
Yeah. It's the first time that I went to the Fancy Food Show was this year. And we, of course, we submitted a couple of samples. And I was just super excited when we heard the news that we had actually won the award for the Coffee and Nibs bar. It's such a new kind of I describe it to people as it's definitely, I call it like a chilled chocolate treat. It's definitely not kind of meant to be a traditional bean to bar chocolate bar. It's much more of a, like a nourishing treat. You know, that's how you and I earlier were talking about how you're not a sweet tooth and I'm not a sweet tooth either. And what I love about it is that it actually is this, food, really. It's kind of as satisfying as eating a piece, like a really beautiful truffle or like the best, kind of chocolate gâteau, those types of, desserts. But what's in it is, the fact that it's made with honey, which is actually the binder for the bar. It's a raw food. It has like all these wonderful nutrients in it. And I just use those five core ingredients, which is, we use the powder, so it doesn't have the butter in it, the cocoa butter. I use cocoa powder, and then I combine that with coconut oil, unrefined coconut oil, so that unrefined coconut oil has all of this beautiful flavor and texture to it. And I combine the honey, the raw honey, with the coconut oil, and we whip that into this kind of satiny, buttery, caramely kind of texture. And then I combine the cocoa powder with either sprouted almonds or in the, some of the bars you have that Peruvian raw that has the almonds in it as the base of the bar, and the Dutch one has the almonds in it, and so does the Mayan spice. And then the other four bars we use coconut. We use medium shred coconut, and we puree that into almost like a coconut butter. Again, it's very kind of the goal with that is to create this like very wonderful satiny texture But it's a whole food. It's this, you know, there's no kind of fillers or flours in there. It's just you're getting all of these wonderful whole foods, but then the experience of eating like a super decadent
chocolate truffle.
Yeah, and does not have a sweet tooth. You said you don't either, but both of you love this product.
And, yeah.
There's another ingredient that you haven't mentioned that's in there. It's called calories.
Yeah.
There are a few of those in there too.
There's a couple calories. Well, so the calories, you know, what I always laugh with people about is that it's a, you know, it's a nutrient rich food, and so there's certainly no empty calories. You know, when you eat sugary, you know, sugar and flour, those turn, you know, they go directly into your body as sugar, which immediately is like empty calories. And with this one, what I love about it is that it really is, you know, it's, you know, I've eaten many times. I've eaten, especially that Peruvian raw.
I love that as a meal for me. What spices are in there?
The Mayan spice has cayenne pepper and Saigon cinnamon.
Wow, that's beautiful.
That Mayan spice one has, I really love that one.
Yeah, I do too.
That was the first one Anna attacked.
That was the first one I grabbed.
How did it do on your palate? Some people, it's like too much. I like the balance.
I loved it. The spice was in there, but it was not like dominating. There are chocolatiers that we've encountered that actually load up their chocolate with spice. That's the only thing you taste. But you don't lose any of the other flavors in your bars.
Now, you source your cocoa powder from a number of different places, including Peru.
Uh-huh. And then the other one is from Agostoni. Now, the company is in Italy, but they actually have a farm in the Dominican Republic where they get their cocoa from.
Uh-huh.
And so those are really the two places right now that I get the powders from. As a matter of fact, it'll probably continue to be my sources is those two. They're just both have super high integrity. You know, they're direct trade. So I like that about it. And then the one in Peru is a co-op. It's actually a co-op of a bunch of cocoa farmers. And just the flavor profile of both of those, just, you know, so there's the integrity of the companies, but then there's also this flavor profile going on that is so, it's amazing, you know, you both probably know just as foodies have all the difference that you can experience just with these pure, you know, just the pure chocolate and how different each, not only each region is, just the terroir of the region where you get it from, but just of the different farms, you know, of the different plantations, you can really taste, you can really play and create whatever palette that you want to, you know, depending on where you source it from. And those two really won my heart.
Well, we just interviewed Fran Bigelow from Fran's Chocolates.
Oh, wonderful.
What she does is, she's, how many years did she say? She's
35
years in business. But what she's done is, consistently, and her children have come into the business, upgrade the quality of the ingredients instead of just trying going for something new all the time. And the cacao farmers, apparently, have responded in a big way.
That's great.
Yeah, they pay them more for the higher quality, but they are inspired to constantly produce it.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, yeah. And,
now, you've got another ingredient there as well that you have in common with the owl and the pussycat. If you remember, the owl and the pussycat went to sea in a beautiful pea-green boat.
Yeah.
They took some honey.
Yeah.
And plenty of money wrapped up in a five-pound note. Now, you've got another ingredient in here called honey that you borrow from the owl and the pussycat. Do you source that from particular places?
I do. So the honey we buy from Mickleberry Gardens is the name of the company. They're the beekeepers, and they are local. They are, I think they're about 25 miles outside of Portland in Troutdale. And they actually co-op as well with other beekeepers in that area to be able to produce enough, or, you know, to be able to supply us with enough honey as we need. But there, that honey, it is a blackberry honey. Actually, we use different honey generally throughout the year, depending on you know, what they have available. But again, I don't know if you have experienced all the different honeys.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I mean, there's just, you know, the Brix is the whole, you know, that's like this guide, but it's an indicator of how sweet the honey is.
Right.
And it also indicates how loose, you know, or kind of how much moisture is in the honey. And we have to be really particular about that in our bars. So
you would, wouldn't you?
Yeah, there's a particular Brix, essentially, that number that I have to use for our honey in order for it to have the right texture and consistency in the bars, so they don't fall apart, because it's the binder.
Yeah, that's what I was
thinking. Okay. So when you're talking Brix, you're talking the same measure of sugar that there is in wine?
Yeah, exactly.
I got to one up you again. I'm going to score another one after the oil and the pussycat.
I love it.
We have actually had honey from bees that graze the gardens of Buckingham Palace.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
They have a beekeeper who we've interviewed. She's, I don't know where she is on our, it's on our archive, but she manages the hives and on these rooftops in
Buckingham Palace?
They're buildings around Buckingham Palace, and hotel that we go to. She has six hives there, and that's the one of the bees that go into Buckingham Palace gardens. And then she knows so much about bees, about how they do dances. Do you know about all that?
The waggle dance.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow, that is so, bees are amazing.
Yeah,
they really are.
Over London you'll find them, these rooftop hives, and she manages those.
Oh, I love
those.
Well, we need that. We need that.
Wonderful. We got one in Pittsburgh, and we interviewed this guy who's the chef, and he was so excited about this. And then it made the papers, and he hadn't gotten a permit to have bees in his room. So we got a major fine.
All of a sudden, he didn't have any bees anymore. I think he got them back.
He got them back.
He got a permit, and he got them back.
You are living in Portland. You come from a baking background as well as a food background, but you had a coffee shop prior to this, but I'm just curious of whatever led you to this particular product. I mean, it just seems so amazing.
So I was saying before, you know, for me, when I owned Blue Gardenia, it was a bakery and coffee roasting company, and we made all these really beautiful cakes and pastries, and it was, what I found was that not only am I not a sweet tooth, I also don't feel great when I eat a lot of like wheat and stuff. And so the whole time we had that company, especially, I've just naturally not eaten a whole lot of sugar. But as I've aged, I've found that I have become more and more sensitive to it. And kind of just even, you know, to wheat as well. But both of those things I have found that I have tended to stay away from. And I got, so after I left the business to raise my two daughters, my sister ran the business after about 2008. And I was just kind of really went on a friend of mine had a real serious autoimmune disease, and she was trying all sorts of different things to kind of get beyond it. And I was supporting her, and I did kind of a couple of these diets where you really strip yourself of like all the sugars and things like that to kind of get down to the basics. So your body's not working so hard. So it's not inflammatory. So there's this whole quality of that. And so during that process, I just found like all this wellness in those things that I was kind of doing to support her. And I got pretty excited about it. And I started thinking about how can I create something that actually is full of life and full of vitality, like a food. And, it wasn't in my mind necessarily going to be a treat, but I really did want to find something to put out there and bring to the marketplace and bring into the food community that was that kind of addressed the issues that I was seeing more and more of, which were, you know, people having a lot of food allergies and really struggling with all sorts of energy problems and stuff like that. And so I wanted to figure out a way to address that. But without losing any of that wonderful pleasure and kind of quality of just the wonders of eating beautiful food and treats, you know, and desserts and things like that. I wanted to find a way to really bridge those two worlds. And so that, I think, it took me quite a while. I mean, I was going to do a business that was focused on, like, cultured vegetables. You know, the whole probiotic movement was a big part of it for me, and that flopped. It was just not the right thing, and I tried, all these really healthy, wonderful hand pies. But what I knew is that I wanted to do something where I could actually put it on grocery store shelves and not just have it necessarily as a brick and mortar. I wanted to reach, I felt like that there was a kind of a niche that was ready to be filled in our food community that people could have something that was both highly healthy, but that's not what I wanted to say. Yeah. But, you know, just like really nourishing and just by its nature was not inflammatory and, you know, had all those qualities where, you know, you're trying to kind of stay healthy as you age and feel good.
Yeah.
And,
well,
and a big part of health
it.
For me is joy and fun and playfulness and pleasure. And I think that that's the thing I wanted to, you know, you don't have to eat something that tastes... Yeah. You know, there's a time to have a carrot and there's a time to have a brownie.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just kind of, almost any time to have honey moments.
Yeah, honey and chocolate.
Yeah.
And she's panting. She wants to get off the air so she can go down and get a bite.
So, listeners, do check out their website is honeymamas.com and try this product. I mean, it's so satisfying. I really can't even praise it enough. And I thank you, Christy, for talking to us.
You bet. And one last thing is I just want to note that, you know, these are in the refrigerator. So they're not on the chocolate bar aisle. They're in the refrigerated, the grab-and-go refrigerated, like with the other refrigerated desserts.
Yeah, well, grab-and-go.
Yeah.
That's where mine live because that's where mine lives.
Yep. No. So thank you so much.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Next up, Le Bon Magot, which means a surprise treasure. And
it seems like it ought to mean something else, doesn't it?
Well, there are lots of...
But there's only one G.
Yeah, right.
Go ahead, Le.
There must be some way to pronounce it. It doesn't sound like the other thing. Well, anyhow, I mean, they make lots of different things. But we were concentrating on their... what do you call it?
Chutneys and pickles,
and boy, are they good.
Fascinating combinations of fruits, vegetables, and sugar, and spices.
And we're going to be talking to Naomi Mobed, and she'll tell you what they are and why she makes them. We have been having a delightful time sampling the products from this miraculous new startup. Naomi Mobed, you are... the person behind this company called Le Bon Magot. And I was astounded because I've been following the Fancy Food Show for years, of course, to find that you absolutely cornered the Sophie market with 5 Sophies this year.
We did indeed. It was an embarrassment of riches. We were incredibly surprised very humbled and very grateful for it. So,
you know, Peter did the arithmetic. This company won more than 3% of all the Sophies that were handed out. Can you believe that?
And you're how old? How old is the company, Naomi?
We are just barely over 2 years old. So we incorporated ourselves in February of 2015, and in August of that same year, we hit the shelves. So we did a lot of due diligence beforehand of our flavors, you know, where we were going to be able to sell. And we really started this more as an experiment. We wanted to share the way that, you know, we eat at home broadly and beyond our friends and within our community. So we thought that, you know, this would be an interesting experiment. And, you know, what's the worst that'll happen?
The name, by the way, means hidden treasure.
Absolutely.
Right.
Okay. And home, which home are you talking about? Are you talking about England,
England
or Pakistan?
No, so a home right now means Lawrenceville, New Jersey, which is where my company is incorporated and based. We source a lot of our ingredients from both New Jersey and New York, which is where we make the products today. We make them on the North Fork of Long Island. So we are in one of the most ingredient-rich corridors, I think, certainly in the Northeast United States. So we're very lucky. We're surrounded by farmland.
Well, I loved reading this. Just listen, listeners. Naomi was born in Karachi, raised in Tehran, lived in Hong Kong, educated in Princeton, Boston, and London, worked in New York, Paris, then Dubai, then Muscat, and then Johannesburg, and all points in between. That's quite a background, Naomi.
It is. My family moved around a lot because my father was in the oil industry many years ago. So we moved from place to place, eventually landing up in the Midwest in Oklahoma our gateway and our entry into the United States.
Oh, my. We lived in Kansas City, so I sort of understand what that part of the country
is like. Oh, really? We moved to Oklahoma, Bartlesville, Oklahoma, to be exact, as our first point of call.
Oh, sure, sure. That's the home headquarters of Phillips 66, right?
That is correct. Now known as ConocoPhillips.
And a beautiful Frank Lloyd Wright building.
Absolutely. Yep.
That's the inspiration for one of the earliest pop paintings by Robert Indiana. It was called Phillips 66.
Oh, really? Yep. So
you should buy that.
We landed up in Bartlesville, and incredibly, I think out of a lot of other places in the Midwest, we were very lucky to have done so. Bartlesville is incredibly well endowed, and also because of, you know, Phillips had so many holdings in the Middle East, certainly in the 70s. With the revolution in Iran, it meant that so many expatriates were being brought home to head office. We were part of that whole crew coming from overseas, and quite a shake-up for this little town of 45,000 people at the time.
I should say.
So food was very much a common denominator. The fact that, you know, we were not necessarily able to source you know, a huge variety of spices. At that time, so much was being brought over every time we went overseas in a suitcase, come back to be able to cook some of the more traditional, heritage-based, you know, foods that we, you know, that we were used to. But that food became a common denominator that we would share with friends, and folks locally started understanding where we came from. We took on board a lot of new recipes, new techniques, new processes from Midwestern and Southern cooking, different methods of barbecuing, barbecue sauces, the regional variations between them. And we incorporated that, and certainly my mother, you know, at the time, incorporated that into our home cooking. So it was really quite an interesting experience for 6 years or so.
Now, what you must have been doing a lot of different studying. What kinds of things did you study, and how did you settle on a career in food?
Well, I actually haven't had a career in food. after my undergraduate degree, you know, which I did in New England, at that point was when I thought I was either going to go to culinary school or graduate school, and it was graduate school that actually took me to England. So I didn't go down the culinary route at that time. I went to the London School of Economics and, you know, went to England with the thought that I was going to finish my PhD and come back here. Instead, I stayed in England and worked. And, you know, basically I was constantly fueling this passion for wanting to do something around food and culinary. And wasn't, you know, always wanted to open up a little patisserie, something small. You know, I never felt that I was going to be able to excel to a Michelin star level and cook at that kind of technical level, which requires a pedigree and grooming at certain restaurants and, you know, or culinary school. And I always felt like I never was adequate enough. So I thought a little patisserie, something that's my own, eventually I'd love to be able to do. And after moving from, I actually did my degree in politics and international relations, wound up in banking and finance, moved into private equity. And after the last stint with private equity, I thought, you know, I need to draw a line under this and move on. So when I returned to the United States, I thought this would be the right time to either sink or swim with my own food business. Uh-huh. Then it was a question of defining it. Yeah. And
so how do you define
it? Doing?
How would you describe the products?
The products are traditional. They're authentic. However, they do leapfrog into being more than simply ethnic products eaten with traditional foods.
They're very sophisticated. I mean, they're amazing.
You know, the spice blends, the irony is that they're actually very simple.
Mm-hmm.
The simplicity is what makes them sophisticated because we use fresh produce. What you're eating in our tomato chutney is literally fresh diced tomatoes.
Mm.
We peel them, we oven roast them, we peel them, we dice them, and we slow cook them. So, you know, when you're biting through ginger, it's not ginger powder, it's not an extract, it's fresh ginger.
You see, that makes a difference, yeah.
We use incredibly high quality spices. Sometimes the spices are toasted. They're treated in the manner that they should be to be able to extract the most amount of flavor from them. You'll be surprised at how few spices actually go into our preserves and chutneys, even though they taste absolutely abundant with them.
Yes, they do.
They taste abundant because of simply the quality of ingredients that are going in, being cooked at the right temperature. There's no chemicals or preservatives. Essentially, this is what you would be cooking in your kitchen.
Yeah, and you're conscious also of the curative benefits of these different spices.
Absolutely. You know, so, yeah. For example, in our brinjal caponata, which is a diced aubergine, it's peeled, it's slow cooked in a sesame seed oil. That particular product has healthy doses of turmeric, curry leaves, and mustard in it.
Uh-huh.
And turmeric, you know, is known to have certain curative benefits.
We keep the fresh root in our refrigerator at all times.
You do,
yeah.
Right. So, you know, turmeric is absolutely lovely. I use it in a lot of different things, even in a very hidden way, depending on whether I want a hint of taste or a hint of color. That being said, you know, I didn't start the company with a view to trying to reform anybody's health.
Right.
It was flavor. It was all about the palate, and it was all about being able to use these ingredients in a versatile way. So as much as somebody may want to pair it with a variety, each of these products with a variety of cheeses, they can also be used as sauces. Some of them can be used alongside desserts, a variety of different applications, depending on how easy or complex you want them to be.
And how many total number of products do you have?
Today we have 5.
Okay.
So when we launched the company in February, we started with 3. We launched, we sort of debuted 2 more last year. We actually debuted with 2 dried fruit marmalatas, which really have not been done in the U.S. As such. You know, there's some usage of dried figs, some dried apricots, but dried fruits largely as the dominant ingredient in a preserve has not been used.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a tradition very much part of the Middle East, North Africa, Turkey, parts of North India as well use a lot of dried fruit preserves. The hot climate necessitates it.
Right.
What we did was actually, rather than just having them as sweet preserves, we reintroduced, you know, some spice blends from the region into those preserves.
Uh-huh.
So, for example, we have a lovely lemon sultana marmalata. So it has fresh lemon zest with golden sultanas, caraway, and Afghani saffron. It's literally the color of sunshine. You can see the pellets, the raisin pellets in them quite clearly. And it makes for quite an interesting variation on a traditional dried fruit preserve.
Now, I can imagine the listeners at about this point are lusting after these products. So how does one get them?
Well, very easily. You can get them online through our website, www.lebonmago.com. Or if you go onto our website, we actually have a list of retailers that you can access. And you never know. It could be around the corner from where you live today. So, it just depends on where you're located. We're very lucky. We are selling nationwide, not just through our e-commerce channel, but through retailers as well. So we are selling as far west as Washington State, Oregon, and California.
Wow, that's amazing.
We're also in Florida. So we're quite well represented in a number of states.
That's a good rollout.
But we have a long way to go. So.
Yeah, but that's still a good rollout, I know. You know, I was corresponding a bit with your COO, whose name is Bansal.
Yes, Rohit, yes.
I asked him, there's a restaurant called Clay Oven in California, and the chef owners are Bansal.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
okay.
But he didn't know them. So, I mean, how do you, you're probably already working on your next products.
We are.
And, I mean, how do you, what is the procedure? How do you go down that path to what you're going to work on?
Well, when we started this company, I was intent that this was going to be a multi-product category company. So we were merely starting with condiments and preserves, but ultimately we wanted to branch out into other products, snack foods.
That's a big market, a huge market.
Absolutely. But, you know, so the dominant theme in all of the products that we want to play in, or the categories we want to play in, is the fact that we're going to be focusing on South Asia, Middle East, and African-influenced flavors. That's going to be the theme cutting across them. The quality of the ingredients also is something that is a non-negotiable. That's also going to be key across them. We know we're not going to be able to deliver all things to everybody, and that's not the intent. But it's to basically deliver a few products across a number of categories with these highly luxurious ingredients and interesting flavors. But right now, we're still going to stick with preserves and condiments for a while. we haven't really finished with this segment. So in terms of our process of identifying which products to bring to market, we look at the sourcing of our ingredients. We look, you know, for, I'll give you a classic example. Everyone keeps telling us to do a mango chutney. To this day, I haven't found an easily available source of varieties of mango here outside of my uncle's garden in Florida, orchard, I should say, not garden, you know, which I can use to have a steady source of mango chutney being made and sold in the market. So I will not, unless I'm happy with the ingredients, and I know that I can find the ingredients, you know, frequently, regularly, even if it's just seasonal, I will not move ahead with a product. So a lot of it is about whether the flavors are available in the market, who else are we competing with. We have an armor, you know, an absolute armory of recipes and a pipeline of products we would love to bring out. But there's also the reality of competing with within a highly competitive specialty foods market. So we always have to balance that.
I'm actually looking forward, because I'm going to talk to you again. I know that. Because you're going to make continue making waves in the specialty food world, and I'm excited for you, and I'm excited for us that get to eat all these wonderful things.
Oh, thank you. Well, we certainly are. You know, we're certainly very much in build mode, so we're looking forward to it.
Well, Naomi, thank you for taking time to talk to us.
No, thanks for being interested. We're really appreciative of that, and honestly, just want to get the word out, you know. So we're very grateful.
Anything we can do, let us know.
Thank you so much. Absolutely. And, oh, by the way, if you need any help with pairings or anything, just shoot me an email. We'll send you across a pairings page. Eventually, we will be launching that on our website. We'll have recipe cards, et cetera.
Good.
But we're just not quite there yet. But it should be up and running shortly.
You're moving quickly, I think. Anyhow, it's a delight to talk
to
you.
Yes, but just not quick enough. But we'll get there.
Oh, Naomi, it's great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Have a great day.
You too. Bye. Somewhere along the way in the course of your visit to the Fancy Food Show, you're going to encounter some surprises. And one of these, actually, is it's a trend, I guess. The company is Seawater Food and Beverage, and it has...
And that doesn't tell the whole story, although the seawater part of it puzzled us just a tad.
Yeah.
But we still have it there, and we drop a little in our vegetables every once in a while. but the star of this company are their drinks. The brand is Zuma. But go ahead. They're sort of like...
Well, I like the drinkable gazpacho.
Yeah,
I love that.
But what do they call those things you make in your blender? You know, slushies, not slushies.
I don't know what you're talking about, Rabbit.
They're like kale and cucumber and stuff like that all mashed up together. They're smoothies. You have no help. You're just laughing at me. But the gazpacho and the tomato juice.
And then they had the lemonade.
And the lemonade. They're more like smoothies than anything else.
They're all made with seawater.
That's the link, I guess, right?
Yeah.
But they're absolutely delicious and just the thing to get you started in the morning. And let's see what they have to say about them.
We're going to be talking about a new product line altogether. Is that not true, Austin Klar?
Yeah, it's it's new, and especially to the U.S. The company I work for, Seawater Food and Beverage, originates in Spain many years ago, but their products have all basically are first introduced in the European market and then get introduced very shortly after in the U.S. market, and And so, yeah, very, very all new products and just barely second to what goes on in Europe. So
now the funny thing is, in a way, it's a very old product. It's a product that's been around for a few gazillion years. So,
because
it covers 75% of the Earth's surface.
So there's quite
a lot of it. You'd think it would be really cheap.
There's so much of it out there.
You'd think it'd be really inexpensive, but you've done a few things to it to make sure that it's really special, haven't you?
Right, that's right. Yeah, that's a very good point about the idea that it's a new old product. That's in fact something that I have personally said a lot. We're reintroducing I use the word tradition. A tradition so much as it is something that humans simply did, particularly coastal people, and of course those around the Mediterranean would use the natural resource of this salty water to do all sorts of things, whether it was cook or, and season foods or store foods that, use it for the preservation. And
tell me this. Are you separate from the original Spanish company?
In the sense that we are that original Spanish company in the U.S., essentially. There's Mediterranea, that company is where it began. There's this parent company called, the whole thing is underneath something called Seawater Solutions. And then under that, you have all of our brands and our U.S. division, Seawater Food. There's a cosmetic division called Blue Sea Cosmetics. There's a something that we're actually introducing here to the U.S. Called Ice Ocean, which is a seawater for hydration, like bridges and, sweet hydration gels for working out and athletes and what have you produced. And then we're all under the same company. Myself and Mike Hammond we are the U.S. division now.
Well, so. You sent us a lemonade, tomato juice, and a drinkable gazpacho.
Plus,
potato chips were made with seawater. Plus,
right.
Seawater itself, which was apparently purified by a secret process that you developed.
A patented process, yeah. I guess it is a little secret. Essentially, that first product, the seawater is a seminal product. That's where it all started. Our originators, our founders, wished to cook with seawater in their own home kitchens and make their own recipes with it, but they wanted it to be, they also wanted to sell it, so they needed it to be safe for human consumption, and so to do so, to sell a food product, they had to get the EFSA, which is basically the European FDA, involved, and they asked, hey, what do we have to do to sell this legally as a product, filter it, all that kind of, and they said, well, you have to remove the boron. That's really the part of the one element, aside all the, cytoplasm and the plankton and all the other, the clear, obvious stuff that you would remove. You have to remove one natural element, which is boron, because it's almost to the point of it's not quite to the point of being poisonous, but it's on the line, and so they ask you to remove that down. So we remove the boron. That's really what makes our filtration special or different. Mm-hmm. We do it without, any chemicals. We don't use a carbon or anything like that. We use just a patented physical filtration system. That's how we get the seawater out of the ocean and then put it, and that's where it comes in that bag, that pouch of seawater that you've got. That's the seawater for cooking. That is then put into every one of our products from the Zumo line of Zumo line of juices and drinkable
soup. We like the juices a lot. I like the gazpacho especially. So it's more
Thank
understandable
you.
Since it comes out originally from Spain, right?
Right, exactly. So, and that gazpacho, that's actually our big, we won a Sophie Award for that this year. We got a, we won the 2017, like, new product Sophie Award.
Well, that's how I got, because we covered the, Fancy Food Show every year, and that's how we got.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. That's yes, where you heard it. That's awesome. Well, yeah, so we're very proud of that. I mean, it was, we were really hoping that we would win and, or for some, or at least get recognized, and to win something was really special, and, it is really special. Yeah, the gazpacho, the salty sweet lemonade is really delicious. The tomato juice is, one of the only two ingredient tomato juices out there. It's one of the only, I don't know if it's the only, but one of the only tomato juices made with zero dehydrated ingredients, and that's actually that can be said for everything that we do. We don't have dehydrated ingredients. We don't use preservatives. We use, you know, real produce, you know, no artificial flavors, colorings, no artificial sweeteners. We don't, and but we do pasteurize, so everything has a nice long shelf life. And,
well, tell me, why do you then call for diluting if you're going to be cooking vegetables in your seawater?
Sure.
You use more tap water in it than you do seawater in the water you're going to boil your vegetables in.
Sure. I mean, if you were just to use the pure seawater, you would end up with just salty food for the most part. And there, it all depends. Using that seawater for cooking, using it in any whether it's, you know, steaming vegetables or boiling pasta or rices or greens or making a marinade, a brine, a soup, a stock, whatever, you know, a salad dressing, whatever it is that you're doing with it, is going to determine, you know, a pizza crust, you know, like, is all going to determine the amount of how much dilution, if any, and then how much of the actual seawater that you use. And,
well, I just followed the directions on the pouch.
Sure.
It was like a cup to two cups, I think it was.
Yeah, it all depends on what you're cooking. So if you're
I was cooking green beans, and
Sure.
It my imagination, but I thought my green beans tasted like fish.
No, that's a little surprise. I mean, certainly if you taste the seawater, just as the seawater itself goes, it is pure salt. There shouldn't be. Seawater itself doesn't really come with any taste outside of, you know, the saltiness. And when it's not purified, when you're in the ocean itself, sure, you can get a that sense of it, but we purify it to the point where it shouldn't have.
Okay.
Yeah, it's, I mean, not to call it, say, oh, it's all in your head, but that's probably just in your head. We're very careful about that. The filtration system that we have is an outstanding bit of technology, and works incredibly well. It should be. It leaves behind 100% of the H2. You know, it leaves the H2O alone. It leaves 100% of the mineral and element content, and all of the sodium chloride content, and removes everything else. Again, completely physically. There's no. We don't. And it leaves it odorless, and it leaves it tasting like, if you will, liquid salt. It is, which is
exactly what it is.
Yeah.
Well, no,
hold on a second. Yeah. Let me get a word in edgeways here. Where does where do you actually get this seawater from?
Sure, good question. So we get it from the Costa Brava, which is
All right.
You know, right. That's just south of the French border.
Yeah,
the coast of Spain.
Yeah, we know Spain very well.
We know it well. We've swum in that water. There's probably some flavor of it left.
Maybe that's so why the reason beans tasted fishy.
Yeah, it's actually a really great place to get it, seawater, when you're sea salt or in our case, of course, sea water out of. It has a really high concentration of ocean flora and various types of sea life, it just has ideal conditions to harvest seawater and or sea salt from. And to be fair, all seawater is created equal. Created equal is the key word there. Is that if you went to the Gulf of Mexico, or if you went to the Arctic, or if you went to the coast of Japan or the Costa Brava in Spain, pulling out a cup of that water, and testing it, you're going to get the same concentration of to electrolyte content, natural electrolyte content that floats around it, that is suspended in the water, you're going to get the same concentration. The difference, of course, is going to be just how much you have to filter it, how difficult it is, the perception of where you're getting the water. Like, if people think, like, the Gulf of Mexico tends to have kind of a negative connotation associated with it when it comes to pollution. The reality is we could get it out of the Gulf and come out with the same quality product. It just might be a little more stressful, say, on our filters. But that's going to be the difference. So,
well, listen, two quick things before we close. I noticed that you can get the juices through Amazon.
You can.
Which is kind of really, really handy. What about, does the seawater itself, does that go out through Amazon as well?
Right, so you can actually, so if you are a just an individual looking to purchase, you can Amazon, you can find our seawater, you can find the Zumo juice line and the seawater potato chips and the Ice Ocean, the seawater hydration stuff.
Got it.
That line, all on Amazon. You can also find everything on a website called Yummy Bazaar, yummybazaar.com. They have it possibly for a little less expensive, but Amazon's probably easier to remember and a little more convenient for people. Shipping should be free and all that. And then if you're a company like a retailer or a restaurant or what have you, we can add that via direct ordering and shipping. We can also supply depending on where you are via distributor. And, you know, of course we're constantly looking for new relationships on both sides, both retail, individual retail and food service, you know, whatever it is. So.
Great. Well, thanks for joining us. It's certainly a fascinating story, and you can find out more than you might perhaps like to know.
More than you want to know about seawater for cooking.
On the website, but I can tell you, we thought that the hit of all was the gazpacho.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's awesome. We find that the gazpacho is definitely one of that and the salty sweet lemonade are our two most popular items at the moment.
Yeah,
so,
we wish you continued success.
Well, thank you.
Congratulations on the Sophie that you won, and thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. And please say hi to Mike.
I absolutely will. Thank you so much for your time and having us on, guys.
Well, listeners, there you have it. You have our first report from the annals of the Fancy Food Show and the Sophie Awards, and there'll be more in our future as we bring you more and more interesting new products over the next few weeks.
Yeah, we should also point to the sponsor of this project.
Go ahead,
is the Specialty Food Association, which is growing by leaps and bounds. And go on their website, and you can follow all these awards and new product developments. There's so much out there.
But we promise you on the menu promises you that we'll be bringing you some of the better ones. So
right.
hang around here and learn what we've learned and enjoy as we have been enjoying. And in the meantime, until next week.
Bye-bye.